Let's start by discussing your education and training. Can we start by describing your educational background?
Sure. I was born in New York City, and I went to public schools, graduated from high school in Bayonne, New Jersey, Bayonne High School. I then went to Fairleigh Dickinson University in New Jersey. Got a bachelor's degree in chemistry. I graduated about almost a year early, and so I worked as a coffee chemist at Maxwell House. Good memories of that. In Hoboken. And I used to eat lunch in a little park called Elysian Field, where On the Waterfront was filmed.
Oh, wonderful.
Then I went to medical school at McGill University. Graduated from McGill in 1966. During my summers, I did research in cardiology in Costa Rica. And then I did my internship in medicine at the University of California, San Francisco, 1966 to 1967. During the Vietnam era, was in the Berry Plan, assigned to the Navy, and preparing to send me to Vietnam when I got an offer of a job from the National Institutes of Health in the Division of Regional Medical Programs, headed by Robert Q. Marston, later went on to become the director of NIH. So I came to NIH. I did 1 year with the Division of Regional Medical Programs. Then I began at the NIH a residency in clinical pathology. And I completed 2 years, which was the full residency period. Then I returned to the University of California in San Francisco as a resident in medicine. Fellow in oncology. The hematology training was largely at NIH. I spent, of the 2 years in clinical pathology, I spent about a year and a half in hematologically related work. Then I joined the faculty as an instructor in medicine. That ended my formal education, but not my education.
Of course. What factors influenced your choice to go to medical school? How did you become interested in medicine?
Well, I had some good motives, and perhaps some motives that weren't as high-minded. The good motives were an interest in biology that was engendered by a biology teacher in high school. And the memories I have of that was looking through a microscope at a drop of water from the aquarium and seeing all those life forms. I liked science and I liked biologic science, and I wanted to combine biologic science with some service to mankind. I didn't want to just do science in isolation, but I want to do it in a way that I can apply it directly one way or another to patient care. Suppose I had another motivation too. I recall I came from a poor family, and there was a certain desire to, for lack of a better word, make it. What exactly constituted making it, but I think in my mind at that time, becoming a doctor was equivalent to whatever making it was supposed to mean. And in retrospect, particularly in that era, in the 60s, a physician was held in respect, and that once you became a physician, you had a title of respect. That was different than, for example, simply becoming a lawyer. If you became a lawyer, you then had to become a successful lawyer. So I think there was some attraction to a very clear level of accomplishment. And maybe that wasn't the timeline to go, but it was there. It influenced me. But primarily I was influenced by the good things, by an interest in biology and the desire to be a surgeon.
You mentioned the cultural movements of the 60s. Did any of that then change how you felt about medicine? Since this is the time that you're completing your education.
No, it was particularly at McGill, a very classical school. And I consider that I was privileged to have an unusual quality of medical education. Frankly, a quality that I'm not sure is easily available today. Not only the depth of the medical and biomedical scientific learning, but a deep sense of heritage, respect for patients, the privileged position of the physician with respect to the responsibilities that the physician takes on by accepting that role. And I can recall that I was shocked when I made rounds at other hospitals when I was looking for an internship, particularly in New York, at the extreme informality of the house officers. We pretty much stood at attention by the bedside, one foot away. And it was something that stuck with me. One professor, Professor McNaughton, who was a famous neurologist, used to show us various signs and symptoms of neurologic disease of students. This was before the CAT scan era, and the neurologic skills in localizing lesions were so highly prized. He would point these out in patients who had deficits, but would do so in such a way that the patient was never embarrassed, nor ever made to feel that they weren't being treated with the greatest of respect. And that's something that stands out in my mind. The exquisite attention he paid to the patient and to the patient's feelings regarding their participation in the teaching exercise. So it was a great school, not only for content, but also for philosophy and tradition.
Okay. So then what drew you to hematology and oncology within medicine?
Well, that's interesting. When an individual from a poor background goes to medical school, I think they have a different image than perhaps someone from a privileged origin. I considered medicine to be surgery. This was before I got to medical school. Because that basically was how you fix people. And so I thought I was a surgeon without giving much thought to it. I simply didn't question it. And also, I was very focused on the day-to-day efforts of medical school. this time in McGill, the examinations were given at the end of the year, and if you failed two examinations, one or two, I think you were allowed to make it up in the summer. And if you failed again, you would be asked to leave the school, and a large number of students were, so there was an element of survival. So we wanted to make it, and that's where all my attention was. But I just assumed I'd be a surgeon. And then when I got to do the surgical rotations, I did notice that I was a little bored just holding the retractors. I was so confused that I actually applied for surgical internships as well as medical. And the head of medicine then at the Royal Victoria Hospital in Montreal, Dr. John Beck, who subsequently went to UCLA, and I got to be reacquainted with him, rather accomplished endocrinologist and sort of the senior physician at the Royal Victoria Hospital, called me into his office and said, Goldie, what is this I hear about you going into surgery? So I remained fairly mute and or stammered, probably. And he then said, he said, do you like to sew? And I said, no, not particularly. He said, then why go into surgery? he said, well, I didn't reply coherently, I'm sure. And then he said, well, you know, where you should go is UC San Francisco, and you should go to Dr. Holly Smith's brother. And I went to Dr. Holly Smith's brother. That was, there was a matching program, but I'm actually not really into the matching program. But that was the era, and that's how decisions were made. When I got to internship was pretty much like leaving your life. Not that medical school wasn't intense, but internship was a total immersion. And that year, it's hard to remember any details, but at the end of the year, one had a somewhat Superman-like feeling. Doubt it was justified, but like the most extended boot camp you can imagine. This was at a time when lifestyle, that phrase didn't exist.
Right. Okay, let's move on to your early career after your formal education was completed. How did you end up at UCLA?
Well, first, I joined the faculty at UC San Francisco, and I got into hematology because when I was at the NIH, I was in the clinical pathology program, and one had to choose among hematology, chemistry, or microbiology, and I chose hematology. And even though in medical school I thought I was a surgeon, it turned out I was quite capable, in fact, fascinated to sit for hours on end and look through the microscope. So I repeat this to my junior colleagues, that sometimes we think we know what our nature is, and it turns out that that perception is a prejudice. It's a view that one gets of themselves that's not a studied view. So I saw myself as a very active, physical, hence surgery, or at the least cardiology. Certainly not a passive kind of specialty, which involves morphology and looking through microscopes. But you find out a lot about yourself, and find out something that great patience for. love. And so I always tell youngsters, don't say you're no good at this or you can't that, because try these things. Find out where your inclinations are. So I joined the faculty and began my own laboratory. I'd worked in the laboratory of Martin J. Klein, later to become famous for the first attempts at gene therapy, somewhat ill-starred. I was a junior faculty member. I was, I would say, only partially independent. I still depended heavily on Dr. Klein for support in my research. But I got a great start in immunologic research because while I was at the NIH, I had extensive experience in reading bone marrows. Dealing with the enormous pathologic material that was available. And we also had a ritual in which I would sit at the microscope and the clinicians would bring the bone marrows of their patients, and I would, like the Oracle at Delphi, declare remission or relapse. And I really became involved in the whole process. I got to be a fairly accomplished morphologist when it came to bone marrow. So when I began to do my studies in the laboratory, I directed my work at where blood cells were formed, which was the bone marrow. And what I wanted to do was to understand what regulated the production of blood cells, because I had the then somewhat naive dream that once we knew what regulated the production of blood cells, that we could actually control the production of blood cells, which was really a novel thought for that era. Even many of the leaders in hematopoiesis never believed so quickly we would find information about the humoral factors regulating blood cell production and how we could actually use these. And that's been the greatest scientific joy of my career, was going from a period where it was almost unthinkable to actually seeing it and participating in the development of some of the first hormones that would regulate blood cell production. While at the University of California in San Francisco, I got to know Gordon Tompkins, a leading biochemist whose life was cut short by an acoustic in the room, and C.H. Lee, who was the first man purifying growth hormone. These were two senior scientists at UC San Francisco. And Gordon Tompkins was famous for dissecting the early part of corticosteroid hormone action. And C.H. Lee, of course, for polypeptide hormones, particularly growth hormone. That's the wonder of our academic communities. I met Dr. Tompkins on the bus, the UC bus that used to go back to Marin County. And on Fridays, we would stop and buy beer and have pretzels. And we had a nice bus ride, and I was worried about the people who got off at Santa Rosa, which was the end of this long bus ride, because the longer the bus ride, the more beer you drank. So Gordon Tompkins told me, when I explained what I was working on, he said, well, you don't have purified cells and you don't have a purified hormone, so it's hopeless. you either start with purified cells and go to purified hormone, or you start with a purified hormone and figure out the cells. So he advised me to begin working with corticosteroids, dexamethasone. And C.H. Lee told me the same thing, only he advised me to work on growth hormone. And it was through my connection with these endocrinologists that I got the vision of hormone action and hormones working through receptors, and could actually picture hormones in the body interacting with blood cell precursors, regulating their production. And that set the stage for me searching for human colonies, stimulating factors, which had been identified about 1966, or at least the supposition that they existed, based on in vitro culture techniques that were developed in Israel and Australia. I have many contacts at UC San Francisco that also stimulated my interest. There was a pulmonary physician who developed pulmonary lavage, and it was through him that I began working on pulmonary macrophages and came to understand the macrophage system as an extension of cell production in the bone marrow. So I left UC San Francisco on the first day of January 1974 to go to UCLA because Dr. Klein had been recruited to UCLA the previous year, and I was still very junior in my development and underfunded, and felt that that I still needed additional support before I could build up the kind of laboratory effort that I wanted to. So I went to UCLA, and that was the hardest move I ever made, because the difference between San Francisco and Los Angeles is a lot greater than many people might imagine. But I survived it, and I stayed in UCLA for 18 years.
So while you were building up a laboratory there, did you think of yourself primarily as a clinician or as a researcher, and how did you envision this balance between doing laboratory work and doing working with patients?
Well, in those days, there were very good role models for physician scientists. There was a clear path for the physician scientist. I don't think they would call that in those days. I think we just used the term academic medicine to cover this. Certainly at UC San Francisco, there were an enormous number of role models, including the chairman of medicine, Dr. Holly Smith, who we could emulate. And they used the phrase the triple threat man. Was man because at least prior to that time, this position was man. The triple threat referred to research, teaching, and clinical care. And so you should be a clinician like Sir William Osler, a teacher of Greek mythologic proportions, a fabulous investigator. There's a lot of talk now about whether such a person could exist or did exist, but I believe a person like that did exist. It's a simpler time. The amount of biomedical information is much more limited than there were very clear role models for this, and the goal of the academic pathway, of course, was to become an associate professor with tenure. And that usually happened at the time you gained acceptance to the American Society for Clinical Investigation, otherwise known as the Young Turks. So the pathway for the physician investigator in those days was rather clearly delineated.
Do you feel such role models are now lacking for
it? It's a lot harder now. The truth is to be a superb clinician, it would be hard to have time to do other things and achieve at that level. What I find myself doing over the years to try and maintain clinical prowess, such as it is I constrain my clinical activities to a narrower and narrower range. So when I finished my fellowship, I took the boards in oncology the first year they were given. I'm not sure I know what that year was, but it was the early 70s. I thought it was a fairly easy examination. Now it's a comprehensive one. But my clinic contained patients with brain tumors, breast cancer, hematologic cancers, gynecologic cancers, cancers of all kinds, because the surgical specialist, didn't want to deal with advanced cancer with metastatic disease. That was a medical oncologic problem. Also, I have to say that oncology was not held in high esteem in that era. It was not one of the classical medical specialties, such as metabolism or endocrinology or cardiology. And I would see a clinic sometimes 15 or more patients with a quote degree of tumors, which today would be unimaginable, particularly at the institution I'm at now, where the whole basis of our care is super subspecialized. We also used to mix up our own chemotherapy.
Mm-hmm. If you can put yourself back in the 70s, where did you see your research going at the time? And where did you see your career going at the time?
Well, in the early 70s, I was pretty well set on the quest to understand what regulates the production of blood cells. And I was in a very good environment to pursue that, because there's a very ample scientific collaboration and collegiality, an informal environment, which some ways is lacking today, a culture of scientific collegiality, a very strong culture. The bus to Marin. I'm sure there are many stories very much like mine of the direction of people's research being governed by interactions on the bus. Also, there was a culture of studying human disease, studying it in humans, and taking blood and studying that blood, and of course the hematologist was particularly focused on that. I set up the first bone marrow donor, normal bone marrow donor program bone marrows were considered very painful in those days. I think they were painful because they weren't done very well. Frequently they were done in the sternum. And when I put up the signs that we would pay $50 for a bone marrow donation, my colleagues, my junior colleagues, laughed at me and said, no way. And so I became the first volunteer, and Dr. Klein did a bone marrow on me. Unfortunately, he did a sternal bone marrow, and they are painful. And subsequently, I've had many bone marrows done, but they're done in the posterior ilium. A bone marrow aspirate can be done without much pain, and without much discomfort at all. And ultimately, $50 was a lot of money in the early 70s. Ultimately, I had a lot of donors. Remember, my secretary was a conscientious donor. And so we obtained human material to work on, human bone marrow. And I was working on these bone marrow cultures where I could use my morphologic skills as well as some of the biologic studies. And as I mentioned, we also looked at macrophages. I got an understanding of how macrophages evolved from bone marrow progenitors as well. And in addition, we subsequently found out that macrophages can proliferate in situ. So one of the exciting works of that early time was a Nature publication I had showing that the human alveolar macrophage was capable of replication. And that was done in collaboration with a pulmonary colleague. Unbelievably, he used a Foley catheter. Foley catheters are normally used to drain the bladder, but they're made of soft rubber, and he found it ideal for doing alveolar lavages. And I even did an alveolar lavage on him. His name was Theodore Finley, originally from University of Washington in Seattle. And a lot of the early work was what we might call descriptive now, but I was searching for the cells that produce colonies in the practice. And one of the early works showed that the monocyte in the peripheral blood produced it. And subsequently, we showed that the activated lymphocyte, which we later came to understand as the T lymphocyte, produced colonies in the factor. So the early work was ascertaining the cellular origin of these colony-stimulating factors and determining some of the modulators of them. For example, endotoxin was known to stimulate colony-stimulating activity production in mice, and I ultimately went on to do this in humans. And there's a well-known story of auto-experimentation where animals died at the UC San Francisco. What I was doing, it's shown that if you inject endotoxin in humans, you could increase the serum concentration of colony-stimulating factor. I had the notion that one could produce colony-stimulating factor by injecting endotoxin, take off the plasma, and then use that plasma therapeutically. And here again, the advantage I had was that due to my background and contact with endocrinologists, I had a vision of how these colony-stimulating factors worked as hormones. And when I say vision, I mean it quite literally. I had a an actual picture, just another hormone that interacted with a receptor on the cell. Now, others in hematology, even though they themselves discovered many important components of the hematopoietic system, somehow never believed, very skeptical, that these factors were actual physiologic factors that we could use to actually control blood cell production. So these early experiments with endotoxin ended up where I injected myself with perhaps too much endotoxin, and went on a cell separator so that we could obtain an adequate amount of plasma. And I guess the combination of the endotoxin and the fact that I was having a reasonable amount of my plasma volume removed caused me to lose consciousness. But I had an agreement with the woman who was running the machinery that should I pass out, just give me back some of that plasma. And she did that, but in the interim, she also called a code blue, called the cardiac team. So luckily, my consciousness returned before this team dispatched me to my eternal rest. And there's a famous story, and that many people talk about it. Anyway, ultimately, we showed that this plasma, when given to a single patient, a child with neutropenia, actually stimulated the production of neutrophils in that child. And, of course, that experience left me absolutely and totally convinced that that we could isolate these colony-stimulating factors and that they would prove therapeutically useful.
So can you just reiterate what colony-stimulating factors are useful for?
Yeah. Well, now, of course, there are actual drugs, and they're not called colony-stimulating factors. But the hormones that regulate hematopoiesis are now a broad family. Erythropoietin is the best known, and erythropoietin stimulates red cell production. It's used widely in renal dialysis and kidney disease. It's used very widely in cancer therapy. Now it seems commonplace to think of stimulating red cell production, but it was hard to conceive of it at one time. The white cell colony stimulating factors, there are known as GM, CSF, granulocyte, macrophage colony stimulating factors, GCSF, these have been developed as drugs used to stimulate white cell production, mainly in cancer-related conditions, but also in others.
Okay. If we can return to this question of materials for a bit, you've talked about self-experimentation and also obtaining materials from other lab workers and from donors. Do any of these come from patients, and how are materials obtained for research purposes from patients?
It was very commonplace in the 70s, even the late 60s, to study patient material. And before the biotechnology revolution, I would say that it was only medical scientists who pretty much did that. And that's what defined the medical academician, was someone who studied human disease in humans. And it was uncommon for a PhD scientist, I think, to actually directly study human material. Cell lines were derived much earlier than the 60s, but and these cell lines became important reagents for biologic study. But directly studying human material was in the province pretty much of the academic positions. By the time I began my career, we had IRPs, we had human subject protection committees, and review committees, and one got informed consent. I think the hematologists probably were most used to this because drawing blood was so common. So we were used to doing that. Bone marrow was a little bit of a step, and I'm sort of amused now that it's commonplace. And as you know, people donate large volumes of bone marrow for actual transplantation.
Who would have access to these kinds of materials, and would researchers share those, or would they remain within?
The primary tissue was generally shared within laboratories, but no one had much notion of sending them anywhere. They were perishable anyway.
Okay.
Cell lines were more available, but many of them weren't useful, particularly some of the hematopoietic cell lines, large numbers of them were leaky virus transformed B cells. Didn't always represent the underlying disease process.
Did you have much interaction with the ATCC at that point? Did people who work on cell cultures do much with?
Well, I don't remember when I learned of them. I didn't have a lot of contact with them early, but they've been in existence quite a while. I dealt almost exclusively with primary tissue, and frankly didn't have a good notion regarding the utility of cell lines and what I was doing initially.
Mm-hmm.
Subsequently, I was.
As cell lines started to become more useful to you, what kinds of things would you look for to determine whether it would be worth the effort to do a cell line? I know in the 70s it took a lot more. It was more complicated to establish a cell line than it might be now.
I frankly didn't know much about. I knew about their existence. I didn't use them because there weren't great hematopoietic cell lines. I was working with myeloid tissue. There wasn't a myeloid cell line that you could use. The lymphoid cell lines were frequently PBB transformed B cells, which were things I was interested in. And I would have to say that I was sort of determined that primary normal tissue was the important thing for me to work on. And I would say my early work was entirely focused on that. I think I ignored the established cell lines until later. Later, getting back to my conversation with Gordon Tompkins, who said you either have purified cells or purified hormones, if you have neither, to get it. I came to understand that I did need pure cell populations to work with, and particularly when we were looking for a source of colony stimulating factor to purify. And we looked at a number of established cell lines, but I didn't have a sense that non-hematopoietic cells would make the colony stimulating factors. Now others found cell lines that non-hematopoietic cell lines that did his bladder cell line from which GCSF was purified here at Memorial Sloan Kettering. My initial work showed that macrophages, monocytes, made the colony-stimulating factor that I was studying, as well as activated T lymphocytes. And so that's where I focused my efforts. There weren't good macrophage cell lines, and most of the T cell lines that were available weren't mature T cells, and so tended not to make it. Now, our techniques were crude too, so mm-hmm. I think with finer techniques, we would have found, as we know now, there are many cell lines and many tissues that make these colony stimulating factors, but we didn't know it then. Mm-hmm.
Okay. You mentioned at one point that the hospital here did have IRPs and human subjects committed. What impact would you say that the bioethics movement has had on biomedical research?